From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. College sports have gone big time for a long time now. Yesterday in Indianapolis, a vote of the NCAA made it official for the very top tier, the Big Five college athletic conferences, a green light to make their own rules on money, recruiting, and more. This hour On Point is college sports top tier going semi-pro. Is it already there? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's this move mean for college sports, college athletes, smaller schools, amateur athletics? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from New York is BJ Schechter. He covers college sports for Sports Illustrated. BJ, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from New Canaan, Connecticut, Armin Katayan joins us, sports correspondent for 60 Minutes and CBS News correspondent, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, out in paperback this month. Armin, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Tom.
BJ, what happened in Indianapolis? What just happened there?
Well, the NCAA Board of Directors made not a very surprising move, but they unanimously voted, I think it was a 16-2 vote, to allow the Big Five conferences, which are now called the Group of Five, that's major schools from the SEC and the Big Ten and the Big 12 and the Pac-12. There are 64 schools in total, schools that you would recognize, Ohio State and Texas and Alabama, UCLA, yeah. Washington, the like, to basically form their own division and have some of their own rules and be allowed to pay stipends to players, to have different recruiting rules. It is essentially the most powerful schools and conferences seeding from the union.
The Southeastern Conference, the Atlantic Coast Conference, the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the Big 12. Armin Katayan, why did this happen? Why did they make this move?
Well, it reflects the reality of college athletics right now in many ways. One is that college football is more than ever sort of the bell cow, the financial bell cow of these universities, which are using college football as a front door or front porch of a university to help build their brands. And college football has never been more popular. It's never been more a greater commercial enterprise. And the schools that have sort of seceded from the union have been talking about this for about a year now and have made clear that if they did not get the vote they got yesterday in Indianapolis, that they would split off and start their own show, their own division. So it's a reflection of the reality of the times that college football particularly has become this vast commercial enterprise, and it's predicated on more than ever on the popularity of a single sport, and that's college football.
So, BJ, this group of five, with this passage, and I guess it could be overturned if a whole lot of people came back and objected, but not likely, it seems. What will the group of five be able to do that other schools, smaller schools, I guess, will not?
Well, I mean, it all comes down to money and resources, and this is a gap that exists right now, and I think it's only going to get wider. And as Armin points out, especially in college football, which rules the roost, they make the most money. It's probably the second most popular sport right now behind behind the NFL. So this will allow them. They've talked about paying stipends between $2,000 and $5,000 a year per athlete. It's not a salary, but it would allow them to, to go out and pay these kids a little extra so they can,
some
go
cash,
out to dinner,
yeah.
and buy what, yeah, cash.
What it's called, it's the full cost of attendance. That's the phrase that everybody uses, right, BJ?
Absolutely, yeah, but here's one thing to consider, and this is why other schools balked, and even some of the schools in the group of five, if you do it for football players and basketball players, because of Title IX, you have to do it for everybody. So all scholarship players to cover a full cost of attendance. Now, when you're talking about maybe women's soccer and baseball and some of the minor sports, not everybody on those teams gets a full scholarship. So we're not saying every single athlete is going to get it, but it's a significant financial investment that many schools, even schools within this group of five, cannot afford.
So here's one potential area of ramification. Is it possible that some of those schools will close down those second-tier sports, if I can put it that way, no disrespect intended, because if they keep them open, they've got to pay.
Well, you have to be really careful with that because you know, because of Title IX, and you know, we've seen some of these sports be shut down already, so schools could be in compliance of Title IX, and that's been a hot button issue. If you add this extra factor, which is a lot of money into it, it only muddies the waters.
What's going to happen with the schools, Armin, that can't afford this? I mean, after all, the $2,000 stipend, I think that was proposed some years ago. A lot of schools push back and say that's going to be too expensive for us. BJ says even some of the group of five, the big schools, will have difficulty with it. So what happens then?
Well, I think it's going to depend on how these rules are written. Is it going to be mandatory that every school within the SEC, for example, pay the full cost of attendance to that school? Or will it be allowable for them to do it? And from some of the athletic directors that I was talking to this week, one at Kansas State and another one, Steve Patterson at the University of Texas, and even Oliver Luck at West Virginia, my sense is that language is going to be malleable in the sense of if you can afford it, you're going to be allowed to do it. You're not going to be obligated to do it. And as BJ was suggesting, there's going to be some very careful rules written to allow for Title IX compliance. So there's not any issues in that area because these athletic directors are acutely aware of what those ramifications can be like. But if they didn't get what they got yesterday in Indianapolis, I would say that the risks were far greater that some sports were going to be cut because football is without question the train that is driving the entire athletic department's budget. And the schools that are very successful at it are going to have the ability to do whatever they want financially. It's the ones in some of these other conferences, when you look at even Kentucky or Vanderbilt or Mississippi State in the SEC, they're sort of at the lower third. They would have been looking at a situation where they may have had to cut sports in order to be able to play with the big boys within their own conference. So this is not in any way, shape, or form written in stone. It's going to evolve, but as I said, it reflects the reality right now of what's happening in what has become a commercial enterprise. And we can talk about amateur sport, but I think in your open, Tom, you referred to it, you know, this is quasi-professional sport, if not professional sport, played with kids who are 18 to 21 or 2 years old.
And this top tier just floating away. I think I heard you say, if you can afford it, you can do it here. That suggests money favors money in a very big way. There's been a lot of talk about whether athletes were being treated properly within this system. So much money, were they getting their fair share? Were they getting treated lavishly enough, given all the millions and millions out there? But there's also this question about what's happening with college sports. I mean, last month we heard the Atlantic Coast Conference Commissioner John Swofford. He was telling ESPN that reforms have to happen. Here's a little sound of his voice.
We're behind a bit, we think, and there's some things that need to be done, appropriately done, to maintain the collegiate model, but to also enhance the scholarship and health and safety needs and of our student athletes.
But before this vote in Indianapolis yesterday, here was Kansas State football coach Bill Snyder saying college athletics is focusing way too much on money.
The concept of college football no longer has any bearing on the quality of person, the quality of student. Universities are selling themselves out, no longer about education.
Well, maybe that bridge was crossed a long time ago, more formally yesterday in Indianapolis. Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin is calling. Hi, Mike, you're on the air. What do you think about the new move, Mike?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a graduate of University of Wisconsin-Madison, a Big Ten school.
Okay, so your school is in the gravy.
And yes, sir. But I have no sympathy for these non-BCS schools at all. Every school was a little guy at one time, including Alabama and Ohio State. But these non-BCS schools have failed to invest in their football programs to the extent that Big Five schools have. They have failed to convince their alumni, boosters, students, and state legislatures in certain cases to make this investment on their behalf.
But, Mike, what about Bill Snyder at Kansas State saying that's not what this should be about? It's about education. It's about the amateur college experience. Maybe not everybody wants to invest big, big, big time in college football sports.
That's their choice, Tom. That's their choice. If they choose not to, then fine. But don't complain about schools that do.
BJ, what do you say? We're going to hear from the president of a university, from University of Denver, in this hour, who's not happy with this. But Mike says, too bad. If you didn't invest big, you shouldn't expect to be in this new big league.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a valid argument at all. I mean, if you expect Ohio State University to be on the same playing field as Ohio U, with you look at the alumni base, the resources, that's just unrealistic. That's like, you know, saying IBM should be competing on the same playing field as a startup. I mean, it's not fair. Ohio State has many more resources, just like Alabama has many more resources than Alabama State. That doesn't mean that Alabama State can't be competitive. We see in the NCAA tournament that bigger doesn't necessarily mean better.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In this case, the resources and the divisions, the levels, they're just different. So the big schools are saying we want to compete on our own playing field, and I certainly see that argument.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the NCAA opening the way to bigger money, bigger recruiting, bigger everything maybe in top-tier college sports, creating almost a pro tier among what's being called now the Group of Five, the five big conferences that have, as of a vote in Indianapolis yesterday, been given a whole lot more leeway in how they handle money and players and recruiting. The Southeastern Conference, the Atlantic Coast Conference, the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the Big 12. Armin Katayan joins us, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. You know him from 60 Minutes Sports and a 60 Minutes correspondent. B.J. Schechter is with us. He covers college sports at Sports Illustrated, joins us from New York today. Lots of people responding online. You know, Joyce, she's old school. Student athlete is a student first. College exists for education, not for making enough money to pay a coach too much money. Charles, though, is sympathetic, Armin, BJ. He says, college athletics is a full-time job that precludes poorer athletes from being able to get a paying job. I see nothing wrong, he writes on Facebook, with giving athletes a monthly stipend to at least give them a little spending money to buy gas or a train ticket to go home for an occasional weekend, like any other student. But Scott says, looking at this new tier, the top tier, the NCAA is clearly stacking the deck in favor of schools with big budgets and big TV contracts and making a two-tiered system that stinks like the wealth gap. Let's call it college apartheid. What do you say, BJ?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we all knew that the college sports model is broken. It's been broken for a while. This is a step. I think this is a Band-Aid to a larger problem. I think we all saw, those of us who have been in it, have been seeing it evolve into what it is, and it's pseudo-professional sports. And when Taylor Branch a few years ago wrote the wonderfully long and insightful piece in The Atlantic, I think everybody else that wasn't following it so closely really saw it for what it is. And I think this is a step. Is this the answer? No, but I think many of these things that are happening probably need to happen. But essentially, if we're going to fix college sports and get it to where it needs to be, it's going to have to be blown up.
We're going to hear in just a second from a college coach who says, yes, this director says this is the way to go. John in Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I think this is a dreadful decision. I mean, it's not a perfect world now. That's for sure. There are a lot of problems, but there's so many things wrong with doing it this way. I'll give you at least two if I can.
Okay.
Number one, at a school like the University of Texas, where I live here,
yep, in Austin,
the money already is heavily weighted towards football and the athletic program, to the detriment of the academic and research programs. They're shutting down major research activities and cultural activities because they have to pay for all of what they're doing now.
Yeah.
When this happens, it'll become a football factory, and you might as well close the academic departments down. Number two, this doesn't create a two-tier system. It creates a three-tier system. You'll have a pro league, the NFL.
Yep.
You'll have this elite-level college league, like a minor league, a farm league for the pros, and then you'll have everybody else. And there'll be no pretense whatsoever about good high school players going to a good school. They'll simply be going to a football factory, and only a few of them will get a chance to play in the pros. So it'd be devastating for the young, poverty, poor athlete who's trying to get himself out of whatever into
situation he's in. John, I really appreciate your call there from Austin, from UT territory. Armin, how about it? This is to the detriment of everything else, education, research. It just turns schools into a football factory. Might as well close the rest down.
Well, that's just not true on so many levels. I mean, first of all, let's be honest about a couple things. Yes, there's the Power Five or the five families, whatever you want to call them, but the other conferences, the 27 other conferences that are involved in Division One, essentially signed off on this in a revenue-sharing agreement when the BCS disbanded and became now the college football playoff system. ESPN put in total about $600 million into televising these seven games and $400 million into the two semifinals and the national championship game in January. And the revenue share went from 9% for these non-Power 5 conferences to 25% of this pool. So they are getting more money from a bigger pool. And the payout to the big conference in the end, whether it's the SEC or the ACC or you name it, has now gone to $75 million. So it's not just the haves and the have-nots are there, but the have-nots are getting more of the pie. And to go back to the other idea of, you know, what this is one big, huge poker game. So whether a Wisconsin wants to get involved in it or Central Michigan wants to get involved in it, or in the past a school like Akron has wanted to get involved in it, it's an expensive play. And schools make these decisions because it affects applications, it affects admissions, it affects donations, it affects prestige. And football has become, as I said, sort of the welcome mat to the university. So it's not just about football. It's about elevating the image of the university, which elevates donations, which I would suggest also finds its way into other areas across the campus. And in many of these cases, these athletic departments are self-sustaining. They're giving money, as Alabama does and Texas does, back to the university from the profits that are coming from the athletic department.
Point taken, though, in many they're not. Forgive me, I've got to jump to Morgan Burke. I've just got him for a minute here from one of the big schools, Armin Kentayan. Please stand by there. West Lafayette, Indiana, Purdue University. Morgan Burke is athletic director there, membership of the NCAA Leadership Council. Boilermakers, of course, Purdue plays in the Big Ten Conference. Morgan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
You welcomed the vote yesterday. Why?
Well, we're a little bit gridlocked. You have 351 schools in Division One, and trying to get any semblance of meaningful change is really difficult. And, this process, I think people are focusing on all the extremes that can happen, and I guess that's appropriate, but what we've done is we've carved out some items that we think need attention. They're items that you're not necessarily going to get unanimity among all 65. So I think that this concern that somehow all 65 are going to move in lockstep is probably wishful thinking. And the rest of the items, the whole notion of how many scholarships and the academic standards all remain part of the shared governance model. So, democracy is not easy, and it's messy, but it can create a process for sustainable change, and, that's certainly our objective.
Do we, in fact, with this, have a semi-pro system at the top of college athletics now?
This is one person talking, but I would argue that we are not professional, we are not amateur, we are uniquely American. There's no other system in the world that has a process that combines education and athletics the way we do. There's $2.7 billion worth of financial merit-based aid that flows through Divisions 1, 2, and 3 that allow young people to compete at the highest level they're capable of, get a world-class education, and then become leaders later in life. Now, we have lots of warts. We have things that need to be fixed. There were things 100 years ago that James Smart, who was the president of Purdue, started the Big Ten, was trying to fix. And some of the issues appear similar. But, boy, I hope we don't lose sight of the fact that we turn out great leaders. All you have to do is look around the country at people who are former athletes and have gone on and really distinguished themselves. So I don't want to lose that. I think it's a unique way for kids to kind of grab hold of an education, leave if they're full scholarship athlete, debt-free. There's a tremendous amount of benefit to this country, but we have some things we need to fix.
Morgan Burke, is this, you're there at Purdue, is this in part because athletes have been threatening to go off and unionize if you don't pay more attention to their needs, Northwestern and all?
Let's just use one example, Tom. Everybody is kind of up in arms about the cost of attendance and filling this gap. You go back in the 60s, there was such a thing called laundry money. It was incidental expense money that universities were allowed to pay to their scholarship athletes. If you take $15 a month, multiply it times 12 months, future value of that over 50 years at 5% is $2,000. So I would argue that all we're really doing is recognizing at one point in time we were giving a full scholarship. In 1972, that stipend came off the table.
Yep.
You're now 40 years later, and you're saying, you know what? You say you're given a full scholarship, but you're not. You're not covering the incidental expenses.
You've got a lot more freedom now with this change 40 years from now. Is that $2,000 going to turn into a salary? Are we going to, you know, you're going to be competing for these young athletes?
I don't think so. You know, I think the challenge confronting this will be to try to make sure that the cost of attendance closes the gap and doesn't become a competitive tool. And I think there'll be lots of different models. The ACC has some ideas. I have some ideas. Others will. And it's how you bring it to fruition. But if you stay focused on trying to just recognize you're trying to cover the gap. The gap covers travel expenses on campus, travel expenses home for holidays and the like, and miscellaneous expenses, apparel, clothing, toothpaste, you name it. You're trying to make sure that the kids are made whole. And so we have a challenge to figure the mechanics out, but I think there's general agreement it's fundamentally fair to do this. And I think the other thing that hasn't come out enough is that the student-athlete will be represented for the first time in my career at every single level of this process. And I think we've learned a little bit from the Olympic movement where the Olympic athletes have been involved with their national governing boards over the last several years. I think it will be instructive to us to make sure we're good listeners, we engage, and have them part of the process, which they have not been in a more formal way in the past.
And off goes the top tier, Big Ten Conference, Purdue University Athletic Director Morgan Burke there. Mr. Burke, thank you very much for being with us today.
You bet, Tom. Have a good day.
Morgan Burke in West Lafayette, Indiana. Let's go to somebody who's been watching this very closely and speaking out not so happy about it. We'll go to Denver, Colorado now. BJ Schechter, Armin Katayan, standby. With us from Denver is Peg Bradley-Dopez. She's vice chancellor for athletics at the University of Denver. Former women's volleyball coach at University of Michigan, UNC Wilmington, Miami University. Took her teams to 4 NCAA tournaments. Most of Denver's teams are in the Pioneers, play in the Summit League. It's not one of these Big Five, Group of Five conferences. Peg Bradley-Dopez, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
What do you make of the vote in Indianapolis by the NCAA yesterday?
Well, I think it created a great tipping point to increase conversations and dialogues on individual campuses, conferences across the country. And certainly this is a great time to get presidents and chancellors, board of trustees, regents at the table saying, okay, how does this affect us, and how do we at best move forward, making sure that our athletic program is aligned with our university mission and that we continue to field very, very competitive teams that compete on a national level?
You've said that this is going to drive a big wedge between the haves and have-nots. Your words, how, why?
Well, I think both BJ and Aaron said it earlier, the wedge has already been there. There's always been that gap. I think when you're talking about now not only having additional resources, but, you know, permissible rules and legislation, the competitive gap, the financial gap, is going to be greater. Doesn't mean that we can't win. It just means it's going to be difficult to compete against some of the financial incentives that the Big Five resource conferences will be able to offer their young men and women.
Well, boy, who got to you, Peg? I've seen you in print much more critical of this. You've said there's a tipping point here. Tipping toward what?
Well, I think, you know, it was mentioned earlier, you know, Pandora's box is open, and it if we're not careful, if there's not great discussion, we can create a caste system on our campuses, you know, between the high visible sports and the less visible sports. Certainly the commitment to Title IX and gender equity is of utmost, but probably most important from my perspective is, as we move forward, how will this increased flexibility, the stipend, the full cost of attendance, the miscellaneous expenses, how will that be perceived by the greater student population and the university community as a whole? The devil's in the details, Tom. And when I'm talking about conversation, I believe there's a value in keeping Division I intact. I would say that these conversations have gone on not for 1 year or 18 months,
yep,
but for 30 years. That's truth. And so we've had a lot of good dialogue. How do we move forward and make sure that our young men and women are getting a meaningful education through sport? They get a meaningful degree, and they go on and do great things.
Now,
if we can help them, that's great. But at the end of the day, I lose sleep when the academic enterprise may be at risk.
Peg, stand by there and Denver, if you would. Alex is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Alex, thank you very much for calling. You're on.
Thank you. I called to ask the guests to sort of backstep on a point they seem to be making, but I don't think they are, and that is about Title IX. They kept on using the phrase Title IX and referring to it as it had sort of, in the implication was it had caused some of this leveling, you know, the leveling of the playing field had caused the problem. You know, now all these colleges have to spend money equally and that kind of thing. First of all,
for men's and women's sports, among other things.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And this is a men's athletic problem, not a women's. We all know that as a former Division I athlete, we all know that this is not really an issue for women in terms of exploitation of women's sports. Those women are getting an education and graduating, and we're really proud of them. It's the men's sports that should be worried, and certainly Title IX shouldn't be blamed for that, I don't think. I'm hoping that's not what they meant to imply.
There's a lot to look at there. Yes, please.
Yeah, just the one thing that you have to remember here, and I know this is a hard reality for some people to accept, the men's sports, and particularly men's football, are funding everything. They are funding the non-revenue sports, whether it's swimming, men's or women's swimming, men's and women's volleyball, baseball, softball. Without this rocket ship called college football, nothing else is going to work.
But Peg is worried that this could end up rolling over those behind football sports.
Well, that's going to be the decisions that are going to be made by individual colleges as to where they want to put those resources. But in talking to these athletic directors, they're not going to do anything that's going to disrupt the Title IX equality here. But, you know, the single most valuable asset to these athletic departments now are their big-time college, and certainly in the top tier, are their college football programs. And what they have seen and what they're looking at is between the burgeoning player rights movement with Ramagi Huma and what happening at Northwestern,
yeah,
they're looking out on the horizon and saying, if we don't do something for the single most valuable asset that we have for our entire enterprise, we're going to be looking at boycotts and we're going to be looking at strikes, because that's not far down the line.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this out about the NCAA opening the way to bigger money, bigger recruiting, bigger everything in top-tier college sports. creating almost a pro tier in the Big Five conferences, Group of Five. You know what all that sounds like? Auburn University here claiming victory over Alabama 2013 Iron Bowl.
Chris Davis takes it in the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
And they did. NCAA giving those big schools with the big programs a lot more freedom to set their own rules. What's pushing them? All kinds of things. Among the things, disgruntlement among some of those big college athletes. At a Senate hearing last month, former Florida State football player Myron Rowley said it didn't feel like the NCAA was working with for the players.
It kind of felt like it was us versus them. You know, it wasn't a team. We didn't kind of feel like the NCAA was protecting our best interests, was looking out for us, wanted to see us succeed and thrive and flourish. It was almost as if we had to do everything we could to promote ourselves and to better ourselves against this big machine that was dictating and ordering the steps that we took.
Are they going to pay them, make them fully pro? Don't want to. Panel discussion in New York Wednesday, Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby said treating players like employees won't work.
If we ever go down the path of creating an employer-employee relationship, we will have forever lost our way. Football and basketball players don't work any harder than any other athletes.
But when the top tier is cut free, what about the smaller schools? Cinderella stories, everybody loves them. This year's March Madness Championship Tournament, University of Dayton's basketball team upset in-state rival Big Ohio State. Fans went wild. Here's one student in an interview with Dayton news station WKEF.
Unbelievable. You know, we always feel like we're second to Ohio State. The news always talked about them. They counted us out. We came out on top. Let's go.
Well, can we still do that? Can the Cinderella still stand up in this system? Armin Katayan is with us. He's co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football, 60 Minutes sports correspondent. B.J. Schechter is with us, overseas college sports at Sports Illustrated, with us from New York today, and from Denver, Colorado, Vice Chancellor for Athletics at the University of Denver, Peg Bradley-Dopez is with us. She's got misgivings here. And Peg, you're not the only one. I'm looking here at this Bob Custer, Boise State, of course, one of those Cinderella stories, not one of the biggest, mid-tier, but they've done fabulously well. And Bob writing up some really serious concerns about it. He says, writing here in Inside Higher Ed, says those pesky mid-major programs such as Boise State, my university, Bob Custer writes, and many others have showed up the big boys for what they are, wasteful models of athletic spending that cannot be justified. He's president at Boise State, and he writes, the real goal of some of these so-called reformers is to create a plutocracy of athletic programs that serves no useful purpose in American higher education, and that's from a very successful sports school, Peg.
Absolutely, and I have utmost respect for Boise State. I would say that, you know, at this time, Tom, where we are is, I think there's a fight. Earlier it was said with Joyce's comments, old school, that students, athletes should be students first and foremost. I think in top of everyone's mind, that needs to stay first and foremost. I do think when you're talking about the amount of resources that the Big Five Resource Conference is going to have, it's a game changer. And for us to assume anything different is, I think, a misjustice for the institutions we represent.
I'm not sure I'm following. Bob says it's creating a plutocracy. Do you agree or not?
I would be afraid to say I agree with that because I'm not so sure I know what that means, Tom.
Boy, your phone line must have been burning up. Bill in Hamden, Connecticut. Bill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Yeah, my point was when I went to school at the University of Texas, student athletes already, I mean, especially football players, they had special food special cafeterias. They had people taking notes in classes for them. They had all kinds of special treatment. They didn't even have to go to classes. They had people going to classes and taking notes for them. And to give them even more is kind of just redundant because they already had so much. I had to work two jobs to go to school, and it just does not seem fair to the rest of us. They already were a special class at school, and now you're putting them so far above the rest of the students. It's just not fair.
Bill, we've got it. BJ, what about it? Enough already. There's already a lot of special treatment for athletes, our callers.
Well, I think, and maybe Peg would agree, maybe not. I mean, we need to look at it for what it is. Armin had talked about, you know, football ruining ruling the roost, and I think that's true. When you look at it, football and basketball, if you look at their time commitment, and if you look at the travel, if you look at the pressure, those sports in particular are run like a business, and the student athletes are expected to put in extra time beyond the 20 hours a week. So we need to look at and almost think of football and basketball at the highest levels as a little bit different because they are treated different. I mean, if I had my way, you would develop a system where football and basketball players are not necessarily going to school at the time that they're in season because it's incredibly difficult to balance both when you look at the pressure. So if you look at football and basketball, they generate so much revenue. They're treated as businesses. I think the athletes should be treated a little bit differently in those sports. So I think we need to separate some of this from the rest of the student-athlete population because it's different. Nobody can argue that football and men's basketball at the highest levels is the same as men's soccer, volleyball, or cross-country.
Old ideals or mythology, call it what you will, falling around our ears here. Dan in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was thinking about a caller that spoke about how most athletes aren't ever going to go pro, and it kind of got me thinking that if they're making money now for their organizations, don't they deserve a cut of that? Like, these are often poor kids, and it kind of reminds me that amateurism is something of a sham. Like, wasn't it created by aristocrats to keep bricklayers out of the Olympics?
So forget about amateurism. Dan, I appreciate your call. Armin, I mean, there has been that line out there that these young athletes are being exploited by big institutions making millions and millions, and they deserve better treatment, even a share of it.
Well, that word was tossed around. I was at the Big 12 Forum and on the panel there, and the word exploitation was tossed around. And it depends on the definition. If the system is using you, do you use the system because you have the opportunities to have tutors and the kind of academic care that very few students on campus have access to? You know, the system can work both ways. But going back to BJ's point, one of the things that came out of the reporting of the book that really struck Jeff and I think more than anything, is if you're a major college football player in this country, and I disagreed with Bob Bowlsby at this forum, it is an 11-month out-of-the-year job. Not only the physical commitment, but the emotional commitment, the pressure these kids are under to perform on Saturdays or Tuesday nights, depending upon what conference you're in. So let's call it for what it is. They are under, I believe, more pressure and spend more time. And even by the NCAA's own goal study.
I mean, I had a couple of jobs in college, but I don't think I could have kept those up if I was playing.
Well, they can't. They work 11 months out of the year, Tom. They can't. Yeah. They only have about 2 or 3 weeks in which to actually have a second job, and they spend more time in football-related activities, some 50-plus hours a week, than they do in academic-related activities, which is around 40 to 45 hours a week. So they're really, in essence, athlete students, not student-athletes in these top-tier programs.
It's a big commitment. Dexter in Port Wentworth, Georgia. Dexter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I definitely think that these athletes should be paid. You take a lot of them who come from the poor communities. When you have these directors and directors of the athletic programs making 6- and 7-figure salaries, these athletes should be entitled to be able to live well in college.
So cut them a little more slack, Dexter. We've got it loud and clear. BJ, I appreciate your call. BJ, these changes go to recruiting as well. And I wanted you to lay out a little bit of that for us because, as I understand it, this is opening the way for agents, for more contact with high school athletes, for agents to get involved. Are we professionalizing the recruiting as well? What's going to be the likely impact for recruiting out of American high schools, top-tier athletes?
Well, recruiting is certainly a core issue here, and the amount of time that these coaches can spend evaluating, contacting, whether it's directly to the athletes, whether it's to the parents, is now strictly regulated, and that seems to change by the season almost. And you know, let's be honest, illicit recruiting, illegal recruiting goes on a lot, and it's going to continue to go on no matter what the rules are. So all this stuff is happening now. What these schools are saying is, look, you know, this is really important to us. We're providing more advantages than some of the lower tier schools, so we should be allowed more contact. We should be allowed to make more phone calls. We should be allowed to host more visits. Some of the stuff is happening illicitly, and that's going to continue to happen. So, you know, I think we need, if we change the rules and what have you, it's not going to make a heck of a lot of difference. We need to look at the whole process. I mean, I don't think anybody wants agents involved, and that seriously needs to be regulated.
But isn't that specifically something that's looked at as for more freedom under this new guidelines?
Well, the NCAA can't deal with this right now. Their enforcement staff is so overwhelmed, and they have been devastated by any number of defections and losses within their enforcement department. I mean, they're.
But aren't these? Doesn't this new freedom for the Big Five specifically look toward more interaction with advisors and agents in the recruiting process, Armin? That line seems to be cutting out a little bit. John in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Tom, I have had the college experience both in athletics and academics at two different schools, okay. One which is involved in this five major conferences and one which is not.
All right.
I think this is good. I think it will separate what has been a hazy and very cloudy type of view in terms of the landscape of collegiate football and collegiate basketball. It will clearly now show to everyone what the advantages are with being able to be very financially profitable for the big schools. I think it'll be good for them if they want to become more of a athletic factory to the point where they even emphasize it over academics, and some of them probably are doing that now, especially for the football and basketball.
And are you saying you support that, John? You're in favor of that?
Yes, I think so. I think it's time to separate what used to be a very untrue and somewhat, in my opinion, mm-hmm. somewhat of a facade that the NCAA and certain athletic mm-hmm. and administrations of some of the major schools have been trying to sell to the public about this so-called, quote, student athlete.
A kind of hypocrisy there that you're ready to let go of. I appreciate your call, John. Peg, is this just letting go of hypocrisy? John says,
no.
Hey, you want to make it into sports factories? Fine by me, let's be honest.
I don't think higher education should ever be a hypocrisy. I do not think it's ever permissible to have our student athletes become athlete students. And I think it is not reflecting well on the role of intercollegiate athletics and in higher education.
But aren't you kind of behind the curve there? Armin, BJ is sort of saying, look, that's where it is already, madam.
But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. I mean, where is the strong ethical leadership that we need? You know, why are institutions giving a degree to individuals that do not deserve a degree? Or why are they admitting? And so,
well, you know why. It's so they can win games, win tournaments, get big TV contracts, make millions of dollars, make it their fancy front porch, as Armin says.
I understand, Tom, but the facade is troubling to me. I think there are institutions that are doing it right. I think there are institutions that have resources that will decide not to pay the full cost or pay the stipend because perhaps they don't do that for their doctoral students on their campus. And trying to stay aligned with the university mission is more important than perhaps playing in a bowl game or playing, you know, in the Final Four.
Hold on tight. Clive in Bedford, Massachusetts. Clive, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A gentleman threw in a comment early on about scholarship money trickling down from Division I to other athletes. But as far as I understand, it's only Division I athletes who are allowed to have athletic scholarships. And doesn't go down to Division II or Division III, they're not allowed them.
Division II, you can have scholarships. Division III, you can have them.
But what about the implications, BJ? This is not even all of Division I. This is just the Big Five conferences. What are the implications for other Division I schools and on down the ladder, two, three?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, it's kind of a course correction, because when you're looking at the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that are involved here, I mean, any given Saturday or, you know, during the NCAA tournament, and you go to one of these venues, you watch them on TV, this is essentially a professional sport. So what the schools, you know, you look at these athletic departments, you look at the University of Texas or Ohio State's athletic departments, it's a business. It's a big business. And
they got a waterfall in the locker room. It's fancy stuff.
Well, I mean, yeah, but when the problem is, you have a very wealthy donor that's donating millions and millions of dollars, and they're donating it by and large to the athletic department, and many of these donors then give millions of dollars to to academic endeavors and sometimes to name buildings, and that's terrific. But the majority of money is going to athletics, and it's not going anywhere else. And if these athletic enterprises didn't exist, this money wouldn't be coming in, and that's the issue that that we're really struggling with.
And yet, with all that, a lot of these schools' athletic programs are not money makers. They end up, for all the big money that rolls through there, still being net negatives, but maybe they build reputation and more. Armin, overall, it sounds like you think this is a good direction. A good direction, why? Because it gives more resources for those athletes who are putting their bodies and talents on the line?
Yes, I think that's a very simple way to put it. I think you talk about the waterfall theory. The reason they have waterfalls in locker rooms, as they do now at A&M, they do at Alabama, is because it's attractive to the top recruits in the country. And those top recruits are what drives these football programs, for better or worse. And I'm not saying it's better. It's the reality of what's happening right now in college sports is that college football, as I said, is the it's the big banana. I mean, it's what's driving every single thing. And so I'm more concerned, and I'm against paying the players. I'm fully in favor of giving them stipends, but I'm concerned that they're the ones that are not getting treated in commensurate to what the value they have to the program. And now,
Armin, we've got it, and we've got to go. Armin Katayan, co-author of The System, BJ Schechter with Sports Illustrated, Peg Bradley Dapas in Denver. Great to have you all. This is On Point.